And as many of you are aware, France held a very important election just yesterday. And with us to discuss the election results and the coming second round of the French election is Mark Weisbrot. He's a co-director with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and he's the author of Failed, What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. Mark recently wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times titled, Could a Leftist Bring Growth Back to France? That was published on April 20th, just before this election. Mark, welcome back to the show. Glad you could be here with us tonight. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So as undoubtedly most of our listeners are aware, the results of the first round of this French presidential election came in, and the results not really all that unexpected. The polls had predicted that Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen, the far-right anti-immigrant candidate of the National Front, would be the two finalists that would participate in the May 7th runoff. Emmanuel Macron being an investment banker, former economy minister under the current socialist government. He's never held elective office, and apparently, there's some criticism of the guy for being a quote-unquote empty vessel. But a lot of people are putting their hopes in Emmanuel Macron to keep out of office this far-right Marine Le Pen from the National Front. And, Mark, how would you interpret this first-round results? What was the message that was being sent by the French people?
Well, I think one message is the media is very powerful. This is the problem everywhere. They hardly gave any attention to Mélenchon, who was the most interesting person in the race, if you think that mass unemployment is a problem, or you think that the fact that France has had almost no growth in income per person for an entire decade, and he was the one who actually proposed to do anything about that. Actually, I shouldn't say he was the only one. Le Pen did too. She had an economic program that was kind of Keynesian, but her other policies were so abhorrent that nobody left of center would normally vote for her, although she did pick up some working class voters, of course, who like working class voters, swing voters here in the United States, have voted for Trump. So that's a big part of what you have. I mean, you also have the media has made a big thing out of the collapse of the traditional parties, the Socialist Party especially, which was in power. Their candidate, who was pretty left, he was somebody that, would have possibly made a difference, depending on how much the party would have kept them from doing so. He only got 6.5% of the vote, and that's because of the current government being really discredited for implementing a whole set of neoliberal policies. And Macron was able to break with that government and run as an independent, or form his own party, I should say, in the last year. But he really was part of the whole, the reforms that everybody didn't like. There's a law named after him, the Macron Law, which was passed a couple of years ago, and it made it easier, among other things, made it easier for employers to get rid of workers. And, of course, does not oppose the lowering of the retirement age, which they knocked 2 years off of people's retirements. And it was worse than the way they did in the U.S. I'm sure that in 1983, they in the U.S., we raised the retirement age from 65 to 67, but it was people who were near retirement were not affected. It wasn't going to hit people for decades. Like now, for example, it's hitting people. But The French reform was much worse. It hit people that were fairly close to retirement. So it was very deeply unpopular. And he supports these kinds of things. He's a neoliberal. So you have this terrible, unfortunate second round between somebody who's from the, you know, Le Pen from the National Front, which has a long history of racism, anti-Semitism, and sympathy with fascism generally. She's tried to clean up the image of the party, but it still is like that. It's very anti-immigrant. And, or anti-foreigner, I should say. It's against people who are not even immigrants, but, you know, maybe have different nationalities. And so it's a terrible choice, because Macron is almost certain to continue the decline in French living standards, which is part of an agreement with the European Union at this point and part of the Eurozone policy. And that's the kind of dilemma, because Mélenchon was willing to oppose that. He was willing to say, well, we have to renegotiate these treaties with Europe, with the European Union, if they're not going to let us recover. And he had a big stimulus. And, of course, Le Pen also said, you know, let's get out of the euro. So, you know, I mean, the best analogy for Americans would be like Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, although the difference is that there are some differences. That's what you got in the second round. And that is that Hillary Clinton would not have moved things probably backward here. She, I think, would have been more like Obama, would have had some positive changes, you know, not enough to satisfy most people who would vote for her, but, or not nearly enough, but probably positive, whereas Macron, because of the situation of the Eurozone, because of the stability program, for example, that they agreed to with the European Union, which means more deficit cutting and basically a freeze on real spending, because of the structure of the Eurozone, he's very likely to lower living standards further for the French people.
Well, thank you for that, Mark. You know, I've read some analysis of the election in France with the framework of globalization versus national sovereignty. And, you know, apart from the anti-immigrant sentiment that's running through France in response, I guess, in large part to a lot of the violence that's taken place there by terrorist groups, the fact is that people, as they are in the United States and across a lot of the developed world, are being hurt by these neoliberal policies. It's not just the European Union. It's a whole economic structure. But you point out in your recent New York Times op-ed piece, Could a Leftist Bring Growth Back to France? You talk about basic Keynesian economics of stimulus budgeting that really isn't permitted within the Eurozone and among the European Union nations to really kind of kickstart the economy and reverse this trend of gross inequality and people at the top benefiting while everybody else suffers. You want to draw that out a little bit in terms of what may be being played out in not only France in this first round of the election, but also in Britain with the Brexit election, where those who wanted to leave the European Union won out by a small margin, and of course, right here at home in the U.S. with Donald Trump winning the election.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of similarities between, you know, all of the rich countries have this problem that they globalized in a specific way. It wasn't just technology and, you know, advances in transportation that caused this form of globalization. It was a very deliberate effort by people in power to globalize in a way that put enormous competition, put workers into, or the, you know, the bottom half or even more, 60% of the income distribution in this brutal competition, and then protected the people at the top, you know, the doctors and lawyers and executives. And so you had a big redistribution of income. You didn't have as much in France because they have so much more advanced social protections. You didn't have so much redistribution. But what you did end up with after the Great Recession in France and Europe, they have, you know, the Eurozone has twice the unemployment that we have. That's the 19 countries out of 29 in the European Union that have, you know, the common currency. So they have twice the unemployment that we do, and it's mainly because they can't, they don't have control over their most important economic policies. And so that's why you do see a kind of nationalist rebellion against that. And Mélenchon was the only one from the left of center who, and that's why I think he did so well. You know, he came in fourth, but in the, you know, in the actual race, I mean, the spread between, you know, him and the top, it's, you know, it's basically just under 20% for the bottom two candidates and, about 24% for Macron and about 22% for Le Pen. So, it was a pretty narrow, finish in terms of the four of them, and a very narrow gap between them. And the reason Mélenchon did so well, I think, was because he was willing to say, look, we have to do something. We're not going to condemn a whole generation to mass unemployment, 10% unemployment. You have, you know, long-term unemployment much more prevalent than it was before. And we're not going to accept that, and we're not going to accept further cuts. In fact, we want to reverse. He proposed to reverse the raise, change in the retirement age. He wanted to increase the minimum wage to you know, something close to a living wage, 1,000 euros a month. And so he was willing to do this and say, look, if the European Union won't accept that, we're going to have to renegotiate the rules. And that's really what needs to be done. And so I think, but the problem is that the mainstream media and politicians have this narrative that anybody who challenges that is anti-European, and so they try to lump them into the same camp as the right-wing nationalists, xenophobes, fascists, and racists. And that's, you know, they did a little bit of that to Bernie here in the U.S., right? You remember? They, not quite as much, but they did try to say, you know, some people tried to say that his concern for jobs in the United States, the loss of manufacturing jobs, his opposition to the TPP, you know, you did have some in the media trying to portray that as just kind of isolationist, xenophobic, you know, positions, but not nearly as much as you see in Europe, because Europe obviously has a different history. The whole project of European economic and political integration is always, has always been framed as something to prevent wars and you know, racist nationalism and things like that. And so even this is a terrible dilemma for Europe, because to the extent that people like Macron and the Socialist Party in France accept not only the positive ideals of European integration, which have been there since the beginning, you know, since the late 40s and 50s, you know, but they've tied that to an awful neoliberal project that is condemning a whole generation to mass unemployment and economic stagnation. So that's the unfortunate thing. That's why it was so, this election was so important, because if Mélenchon could have won, you know, France is one of the largest countries in Europe, one of the largest economies, and could have push them in a different direction, possibly.
Well, Mark, French voters certainly have an important choice ahead in the May 7th election, the final round of the presidential election on May 7th. To elect a proto-fascist or to stick with someone who's an architect of many of the economic policies in France that have carried on a stagnation and continued economic inequality. Is there any hope there that the French electorate could send a message to Macron as he runs in this second round of?
It's hard to do in this round because there isn't much of a choice. I think in June there will be parliamentary elections, and there, you know, that's where the positive change could take place, in the sense that if the left gains, if Mélenchon's party gets a foothold and there's coalitions between them and other left parties, maybe some from the Socialist Party will, you know, break away towards them, then, you know, you could see continued progress. But in terms of the presidential race, you know, it's just one of those unfortunate choices like we had between Hillary and Trump.
Well, Mark, are there any moves afoot in Europe as a whole where people are rethinking some of these austerity policies that have blown up in their faces, so to speak, in places like Greece, certainly in Greece, places like Portugal and Spain? Is there any rethinking? Is there any openness to some new ideas about European economic policy?
Oh, there absolutely is. Well, obviously, you know, people in Greece rejected austerity overwhelmingly. You remember the referendum.
Yeah.
In 2015. But then they were crushed. Greece was just too small to stand up to the European authorities. And obviously you have Spain, you have Podemos, which is still, you know, just considering how recently it was created, it's pretty large. They're still pushing, and I think, you know, that's a positive thing. In Portugal, you have the leftist part of a government there, and all of them are pushing back. In Italy, there's a lot of pushback as well. And so it is moving. I mean, if you want to be hopeful about it, you know, you can also look at the European Central Bank has really changed its policy. It was quite awful, especially between 2011 and 2013, and even into 2014. They gave the whole region an extra 2 years of recession, and then, of course, they did horrible things to Greece in 2015 to try and coerce them and then punish them for rejecting austerity. They forced a shutdown of the Greek banking system. I think we talked about that on this show, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
But now they've adopted a policy of quantitative easing, which has effectively guaranteed the bonds of at least the larger countries, and so you have very low interest rates in France and Italy and Spain, and, you know, most of the Eurozone. And that is a big advance. So you could, if you wanted to be optimistic, you could say, well, they finally got the monetary policy right 6 or 7 years after the U.S. adopted quantitative easing. And so maybe they'll move on the fiscal policy. There's been some movement there, too, but they tend to do it in a bad way. Like, they bargain with the member states like Italy or Spain, they'll allow the government to have some leeway outside of the targets for spending if they do these terrible reforms like they've been doing in France. You know, the labor law reform, which makes it harder for unions to bargain nationally or industry-wide. In other words, weakens the bargaining power of labor, tightening eligibility for unemployment insurance, means testing what were currently universal benefits, cutting the minimum wage, you know, cutting pensions. So they still have that horrible agenda, and they so that's, I think, the thing that has to change as well. The austerity itself has mostly been, you know, has mostly subsided. There's not that much austerity. It's just they don't permit the kind of stimulus you would need to bring down mass unemployment in a reasonable timetable.
Well, Mark, we got a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to bring up another topic entirely, spring this on you at the last minute. Forgive me, but, you know, I've been following some of the really unfortunate events that have struck Venezuela, and you and I have talked about Venezuela in the past many times. We certainly don't have enough time to get into a whole analysis here, but, you know, the economic situation is dire, the political situation is dire, and things are just going to hell in a handbasket there. What are your brief thoughts on Venezuela here, and to be continued another time? I know we won't have time to do this.
Just briefly, I mean, two things I think that you would miss if you were reading the mainstream press. One is that no matter how bad it gets there, the major media here still exaggerates it. So it's never quite as bad or even, you know, as bad as they say. So, for example, Maduro's approval rating went up to 24%. Now, you might think that's kind of terrible still, but
well,
actually,
look at Trump.
Well, Trump's a lot more than that, but, you know, there's several presidents right in the region that are way lower than him. Temer in Brazil, for example. Chile, Colombia are all below, quite a bit below Maduro. So how did that happen recently? It's because they're improving the distribution of food. Now, of course, the economy is still a wreck, but I'm just giving that as an example. Like, it will take a long time before the media actually reports that, because they're still going to report only, you know, bad news. And they were doing that even when the economy was booming and millions of people were getting health care and education for the first time, and, you know, in 2006, and you probably remember in 2008. And so they have a very strong bias, but, you know, that's not to say the economy isn't a wreck. The economy is a wreck. It's just never, again, quite as bad as they make it look. And the other thing that's even more important is that you do have this international effort, which, of course, is led by the United States, to topple the government. I think that's the worst thing because, you know, that's what, you know, it's a very polarized country. I mean, the part of the reason that Maduro has 24% support, which is the same he had in the polls when they won 41% of the parliament in December of 2015. The reason he has that support is because, you know, there is a base for that, his party, because for 10 years they had the, you know, huge increases in people's living standards for the majority of people that they hadn't experienced for, you know, many decades. And so that base is there. It's a polarized country, and there needs to be a negotiated solution. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the real damage that the media and its and the United States, which are a government, which are allies in presenting this picture, is that's where the real damage is done, because they could negotiate, they could have a negotiated solution possibly, but these people don't want one. They want overthrow, which is pretty much what they've been fighting for 15 years.
Right. Well, to be continued, as I said, Mark, thank you so much for spending time with us on analyzing the French election and this bit we've done here on Venezuela. So people can go to your website. It's CEPR.net. Is that right?
Yes.
CEPR.net. And that's Mark Weisbrod, co-director with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. So much, thanks so much for being here, Mark, and we'll look forward to the next time.
Sure. Thank you, Scott.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Mark Weisbrod, as I said.